If you lost Survivor and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why Blank lost. And this is why Blank lost. Oh baby, this is why Blank lost.
Hello and welcome to this week's special postseason edition of Why Blank Lost. I'm David Bloomberg, and this is the episode where my co-host Jessica Lewis and I answer your questions.
That's right. And there was a lot of questions. My goodness. Thank you so much for sending them in.
Yeah. I mean, I would say this was the most questions we've ever gotten.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go through all those. Now, normally, of course, we go through and discuss how each player followed my rules or didn't. but this week it's all about the questions.
That's right.
We're going to answer as many as we can in a reasonable time period. I apologize in advance if there are some we don't get to because, like you said, most ever. Some we also aren't answering now because they would take quite a while, and we're considering them, depending on what happens in the off season, we're considering some of them as like full topics for special podcasts. A potential preview. Don't hold me to anything. For example, we received several questions about how the rules have changed over time, which will require more time and research and testing my own memory.
Really falling on you, David.
Yes. Yeah. No, I expect you to go back and figure out what I have changed in the last 20 years.
I'll go look at the emails that I've received in the past few years with the highlighted portions. Yes. I'll start there.
At least start with those. Right. We won't be going through the rules this week, though several of them, of course, will come up in questions. Anyone who wants a handy dandy way to remember the rules, not to mention one that's awesomely drawn by Eric Reichenbach, mm-hmm. you can get them in poster form at tinyurl.com/DavidRulesPoster2.
Yes, and I have the actual version behind me, the size that you would receive. They're only $20, so like fabulous in a frame. If you are outside of the United States, like I've said, contact me through Twitter and we can get that mailed out to you.
Yeah. Now, if you want to wear the rules so you always know them, you can get one in t-shirt form exactly like
this one.
Ta-da!
So just go to robhasawebsite.com or robhasapodcast.com. Click the merch link near the top. Sort the store so the new items are first, and poof, these shirts will be there. And I said exactly like this one. We have both men's and women's, so it doesn't have to be exactly like this one.
Exactly.
Not exactly.
Oh, here we go. It's already here we go. Starting.
That's right. Well, you know, we're using this new platform here. So don't tempt me to, you know, you say it's already starting because I could make you like this big.
I know. Can you even hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, or I could just poof. There you go.
I'm totally gone.
You're gone. So
this gives David Bloomberg. Control. Yeah. There's too much control and power for David Bloomberg on this platform. Too much.
But on the other hand, hopefully this platform won't eat our video and then kind of burp it back up 2 days later.
That was weird.
Which is what happened for the previous video. For anyone who was wondering, like, okay, where'd it go? How come you weren't on video? Well, because we thought Skype had eaten the video. And it did. And then it finally just decided to give it to us 2 days later.
So very strange. But yeah, yes, so hopefully we can avoid all of that by utilizing this. And you'll be nice when I answer my questions and not shoot me off the screen.
Well, it depends how you answer them.
So much control.
That's right. It's like my dream.
That's pretty sad.
I was on a slight detour here. I was on a web conference call that I had set up for work last week with an attorney who, I realized, I said, "Ooh, I have the power to mute you." You know, she was like, "Don't you do it."
Oh, my God. That's amazing. So, well, This is what your dream is. I guess every once in a while, if it makes you feel better, you can shoot me off the screen.
Now, before we get to the questions, I want to mention that this is not the last you'll hear of us or see us potentially in the near future. Even beyond the topics that I was just talking about, people may have heard Rob talking on the Wiggle Room about doing lookbacks at various older episodes throughout the season. And we're going to be participating in that. I'm not sure what the official name is, if Rob even has an official name. I like to think of it as Rob Has a Past Cast. But in any case, the first episode is, well, the first episode ever. We'll be celebrating the 20th anniversary of Survivor next week. So you can expect to hear from us when we talk about why the very first person lost Survivor. And I don't want to mention any names because, you know, spoilers.
20-year spoiler.
Yes, yes.
If you've managed to avoid it this long, that's impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what you can expect for us next week sometime. I don't know if it will come out exactly the same time of the week because the anniversary is actually on Sunday. So I don't know if that's when Rob is going to start releasing things. So the schedule is a little bit up in the air, but we will be here. With that, let's get to the Q&A.
Let's get to those questions.
So my first question is from many people. Where do you rate this season?
See, I'm one of those people that doesn't actually have like a running list. I know a lot of people do. And I just kind of look at seasons as, is this one of my favorites or least favorite, or don't really care for that one so much. And I have to really put this one up there in the all time, like high, really enjoyed it for a couple of reasons. One, it's something that we've all wanted for so long. We, you know, this idea of an all winter season has been something that I've actually mentioned multiple times on various interviews and podcasts that it would be great to see the greats play against each other. So I appreciate that. I do think that some people were kept out of the cast that upset me a little bit. So, you know, not all the greats were out there, but it was so much fun watching this group of people play the game. So I would definitely put it up very high. And also I loved it because we got to revisit people that we know. And I know that sometimes with returnee seasons, people either enjoy them or they get frustrated with them because it's a returnee season. But I like revisiting the people that you've already seen play and seeing how they've changed it up. Are they better at the game? How do they do? What's their story? So for me, definitely in the top. Borneo, still my favorite, always will be. Millennials versus Gen X, I mean, I was on it, so it's one of my faves. But it's way up there for sure.
I mean, that one was okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was okay. Would have been better, you know, if I had.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. There was, yeah, there's at least one way it could have been better. So. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I would put it up top for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I also would rate. I don't have a running list either. I use Stephen Fishback's thing of ranking is reductive and arbitrary. Mm-hmm. But this one I would rate as the top five. Don't ask me exactly what the other ones are in the top five. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would definitely rate it up there. But I also acknowledge there is recency bias here. And there were certainly some problems in the way it was edited at points, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of what just happened there. But if I put those aside and look at how the game was played all along and the winner, you know, it always amazes me that Dalton does his updated season rankings before the finale airs because the winner makes a huge difference.
For sure.
I'm sorry, but if Natalie had won this, it would not be a top five season for me.
Right.
It would be a very different situation. Mm-hmm. We talked about that a lot. So Tony winning does help bump it up there.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm not saying none of the others would have helped bump it up there. I'm just using the two extremes there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where I would put it.
I like it. All right. So FQ asks, did the fact that this was a cast of all winners cause some players to be restricted in their gameplay?
I think that was part of it. Early on, nobody wanted to say a name out of fear of being targeted. Except for Natalie, who named someone and was voted out first, thus proving that there was reason for that fear. You know, we heard several times that people didn't want to name a name. I do think that part of it, as the game went on, was because Tony and Sarah were controlling things so much. There were several weeks in a row where we said, this person targeted Tony. This person was voted out. So I think that was a part of it. And I also mentioned last week on the podcast that Michelle had said something about Tyson returning and telling everyone how terrible Edge of Extinction was. So, you know, nobody wanted to go there, which put additional fear into everyone and tightened up the gameplay.
Right, for sure. And I do think that there were some players that came back into this season with almost a chip on their shoulder, or they had a different reason for being there aside from just wanting to win. You know, we talked about Michelle, how she felt like she needed to prove her previous win. Ben was very kind of downtrodden with how he was presented after his win. And so I think that affected his gameplay. So I do think that there were people who came into the season that were affected from being previous winners. And I also think there were some people that came into the season that were a little starstruck and seeing their favorite players on the beach with them, having to play this game, I think affected their ability to play the game like they would have if they're just playing with people they'd never met before.
Yeah, I agree. You know, that was one thing that Michelle said. She's out there trying to push, trying to play, and everybody's like, "Well, we're just going to sit here. We don't want to say a name. We're gonna wait." Mm-hmm. And you know, she's probably like, "Ah,
yeah, for sure."
So, leading from what you just said, actually leads nicely into the next question from Philip Thompson. Do you guys think social media hate towards players can alter their approach to the game as returnees? Kellen mentioned this about Ben, saying she thought his approach was different this time.
I would say absolutely 100%. I do think that as someone who has been on the show and seen responses that people post on various platforms can be a lot to take in, but you also have to be mindful of the fact that, yes, I'm putting myself out there for the world to see and to judge me and to judge the way I play this game. And I do think that sometimes when people go out into the island, they don't necessarily think about that because the goal is I want to win the game. I don't necessarily want to please the viewers at home. And sometimes the viewers at home are, sometimes a little bit much, and you know, they've got a lot of opinions, which is great, except when it's hurtful. And so I do think that it does have an effect. And I think Ben really hit on this a lot in his exit press when he talked about how he was viewed after his win and the things that people were saying about him. Really, it affected his psyche. And so when he came back out and was playing the game again, he was very, very concerned about how people were going to speak of his gameplay and if he was raked over the coals and took himself off of Twitter, you know, right towards the end of the game. So I do think that it definitely has an effect on people because it's hard to not separate it. You're certainly reading these comments and taking them to heart. And sometimes it's hard to set that aside.
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much said exactly what I would have said. The only thing is, I'd like to think it doesn't affect their actual gameplay. Mm. And it does suck that it affects the post game when they're trying to have fun interacting with fans, and people are coming in and blasting them and just being jerks. But with that said, I think fan discussion overall, I don't know if it was hate or just overall discussion, although I guess, yeah, there was a lot of hate, certainly affected the way Michelle and Ben thought about themselves afterwards.
Absolutely. And I think people should recognize that although all of these individuals who are putting themselves out there to be judged, they're still people. And, you know, so if you want to talk about how they're playing the game, it's one thing. But when it gets personal, then I think it really can weigh heavy on people for sure.
Yeah. All right. Time for the next question from Svi.
Oh, that is this. I'm asking you. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Setting it up so you don't have to worry about pronunciation of names or anything.
I really appreciate that. So where the hell did Tony get coal from?
So, yeah, this question stems from Tony explaining in interviews how he picked up a piece of coal from the fire and used it as a makeshift flashlight, basically, or lantern to hunt for idols. I think him calling it coal was just his way of referencing like the coals of a fire or the small pieces of wood that have burned down. It's not like he went out there digging for actual coal.
And what a genius move. I mean, really, to see him putting that in the shell and then wandering around with it, incredibly smart. I loved it. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So Patrick Alog asks, considering how important final immunity challenge is, do you think the jury should watch that challenge? I think I know your answer.
Yes, yeah. I do. I think the jury should watch so much more than what they see, because unfortunately, once you are at tribal council, you're only getting kind of the narrative that Jeff wants to lay out, right? I mean, he's asking questions and people are reserved in their answers at times. They don't necessarily want to give up their entire game. It's sitting at tribal council. And what you end up seeing more of are those big flashy moves. If someone plays an idol, who's wearing the actual immunity necklace? And so you're not necessarily getting all of the nuances of what's happening on the island. So I think they should definitely get to watch the immunity challenge because it is very significant. But I also feel like it would be very interesting if there was a way that Survivor could allow the jury members to watch what's happening on the island. You know, if you've got camera people there, it'd be fun if when you're sitting at Ponderosa and you've got nothing to do, you get to watch a few minutes of what's actually happening out there to get an idea, as opposed to just hoping to hear about it at tribal council.
Yeah, I figured you were going to say all those things, and I disagree completely.
Ah, oh, here we go. Do I get wiped off the screen?
No, it depends how much you fight back here.
Okay.
I don't think, well, first of all, just for the question, should they watch that particular challenge? No, I don't think any one particular challenge should be singled out. So either they should watch them all or none of them. And I say none, because Survivor is at its heart a strategic social game. And I feel like emphasizing challenges slants the game in the wrong direction. You know, they can see who won. If the person wants to describe how they won, they can do that. I think showing them the person winning or showing someone else how it happened emphasizes that part of the game too much. As far as showing them even more, I think I hate that idea too, because first of all, if you don't show them everything, then that means someone is editing what they're seeing, which means there's always the possibility of allegations of, oh, you are only showing us the good stuff about this person and the bad stuff about this person.
Oh, you know, and that's true. So know, here's my suggestion to avoid that.
Reduction button.
I know you're getting ready.
Yeah.
Well, there are certain areas where the camera people are always there. They're there 24/7. They're following people around. They're always at camp. And I don't think it would be a difficult thing to have just maybe one permanent camera set up, even just around camp, you know, and if people from the jury wanted to go and just watch, like live stream it, like they would do Big Brother. And so it's almost an option. There's no editing. So if you want to go watch and see what's going on, you can, but you don't have to. And you might get nothing. Nothing might actually happen, or you might actually get some really good conversations that you wouldn't have known about before. And it is something that also I think the players could take advantage of, really. If they wanted the jury to know what they were up to, and if they knew that there was this camera, then they could talk around the camera and then give more of an idea to the jury of what their game is about. I don't know. I just feel like you end up missing so many components of people's games if you're just limited to the big flashy moves that you see at tribal council. And if it doesn't get discussed, I'm telling you, it doesn't get discussed. If Jeff doesn't bring up the immunity challenge, it doesn't get talked about. So
I mean, other people, if you want to brag about yourself, you bring it up,
sure.
You know, one way or the other. I just think now this is a little bit different, but I remember on an early season of Big Brother, which I think was Big Brother 3, they did not sequester the jury, and the jury got to see everything that was going on. And because of that, the best player lost because they got mad at her.
Okay.
And I could just see you're sitting around in camp talking about, whoa, we really pulled one over on that person, you know, and that person's sitting there watching over at Ponderosa.
That's true.
It just gives too much information. And if someone wants to tell the jury what's going on, go to tribal council or final tribal council and tell the jury what's going on.
All right. Well,
so
just an idea.
Yeah.
All right. So now we are getting a question from Svi again. Was this game the example of most adaptability between seasons we have ever seen, with Cochrane being a close second?
I definitely believe it was, and I can't think of anyone who changed their game as drastically between appearances as Tony did. He learned his mistake from Game Changers and from his wife explaining it to him. Gotta listen to Baby Cakes. And he absolutely did what was necessary to hide his threat level. So, yeah, I think that, I mean, this was, you know, we talked about it last week. This was as adaptable as you can possibly be.
Mm-hmm, for sure. I mean, Tony was someone whose initial win shocked so many of us as viewers because it was so different. His gameplay was so extreme and really in your face. And he tried the same motive or modus operandi, I guess, again, the second time. And he even kicked it up a notch.
He ramped it up.
Yeah. And he got voted out for it. So I do think that by losing that second time, it really taught him that he needed to pull it back and really needed to pay attention. And we talked about even him changing how he stood when he talked to people, and he would, you know, lower himself and he wouldn't cross his arms. And I mean, all of these things were really interesting to see how much he changed of himself in order to not be perceived as such a threat. It was great.
Yeah. All right. The next question is another one from FQ. Who were you barracking for at the start, and did that change? If so, why? And so for our non-Australian listeners, we found out that barracking for means rooting for, but that rooting means something entirely different in Australia. So that's why they use the term barracking for.
Well, can I go with the positive, who I was actually rooting for?
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, Adam, I was rooting for him because he
way.
I know. Shocking, right? Close friend of mine, obviously played Millennials versus Gen X with me. A great guy. So absolutely rooting for Adam. I know he wasn't my winner pick because I had some concerns for Adam going into this season, with the maybe being a little starstruck. And I think we saw a little bit of that out there. But I was definitely rooting for Adam when it started. And clearly I was rooting for Denise. She was my winner pick. Sorry, Denise. I might have screwed that one up for you. but yeah, and I think overall, honestly, like, I was rooting for a lot of just old school Survivor players because I love old school Survivor so much. And I don't get me wrong, I love all Survivor. But there's just this special place I think we all kind of hold in our Survivor love hearts, that you look at old school Survivor and there's certain things that you miss about it. There's things that just don't exist anymore because it's impossible for it to exist because the game has changed so much and so many things have come into the game that didn't exist then. So someone like Ethan coming back and playing this game now, being exposed to idols and all of these weird, you know, Edge of Extinction and advantages and all of these things that he really had to relearn how to play in a whole different era. And so I think a lot of the old school players as well, I was really rooting for.
Yeah. There were many people I was barracking for that I can't even list them all. Like you said, Ethan and Adam and Tony, you know, could you dare to root for Tony? You know, and you know, Wendell, who, you know, we've met and know, Jeremy, who we've met and know, you know, just all these people, Michelle, I can't even list them all. I feel like, you know, Nick and
basically everyone,
It would be easier to list the people that I wasn't rooting for, but I don't want to. I don't want the hate email or the hate tweets.
That's true.
So I'm not going to do that. What I really wanted overall was a good strategic player to win, and for the Edge of Extinction not to play a role. That's what I was rooting for the most.
Right, and we got the first part.
Yes. And in the end, we got the last part.
We did.
You know.
Yeah.
So. All right.
Okay.
So Stan Sai asks, wait, that's you. Never mind.
Yes, that's me. I was like, I thought you were helping set me up again.
No, sorry.
So just saying hi. So hi back, Stan.
Hello.
Since you guys told us to do that as soon as we became patrons. So congratulations to you, Stan. Thank you for that. Now, I know that there's a rule about not discussing real world, real life politics with another player. But in this day and age, it's also hard to not bring that into one's view of other people. That said, How can you live with an ally's politics, which are counter to yours, while working with them because you need this person? I can imagine how hard that must be when you have to have that in the back of your mind.
Yeah, so I think you're dealing with two different situations here in a new player compared to a returning player game. New players absolutely should hide their political and other potentially divisive beliefs unless they are absolutely sure that they will be okay with the others in their tribe or alliance. With returning players, you can't do that. I can tell you a lot about the politics of many of the players that were on this season. Not all, but many. But the players, I still think, need to avoid discussing it at all costs. I mean, look at it this way. Most of us have friends or coworkers who do not share the same beliefs. Mm-hmm. And you just don't discuss it as much as possible. Now, some of that is when you're at work. If someone has different political beliefs than you, it's the workplace. You probably shouldn't be arguing about that.
Right.
If you're having people over for dinner, when that can happen again, it's not the time to break into a debate about the presidential candidates. Right. So I think it's the same here. You just don't discuss it.
I think that Survivor is obviously one of those games that people look for multiple reasons or any excuse, if you will, to vote you out. And so if you're helping someone decide they don't want to play the game with you, that's not game related, it's certainly not beneficial to you. So if you can avoid certain topics, it's a great thing to do. I can give you a good example here as well. When I was on the island, I found out just from a comment that Ken made about attorneys, just in general, like his feeling about attorneys. And it wasn't anything really harsh, but it was a criticism. And I thought it was really funny because he had no idea that I was an attorney. But we were working very close together. And I just left that alone. I didn't say anything. I didn't explain to him, well, hey, guess what? one of your closest allies out here is an attorney. But it wasn't necessary for me to point that out to him. But I also set that aside because I knew I needed to play the game with him. And I wasn't going to let that affect my view of him for the game that I needed to play. And it still hasn't, but it was just funny at the time. So I do think it's a better goal to just, if you want to play the game with someone and things are working, let it work and don't add anything to the mix that you don't need to add.
Yeah. I mean, in that situation, if Ken had said that and a different attorney was there, they might not have taken it quite so well. They might have been like, what's this guy talking about? I don't want to, work with him. So yeah.
Yeah. It's a dangerous thing to do. So if you can avoid it, it's better to avoid it.
Right. Right. All right. Next question is from Terry Porter. What was the worst vote off of the season and why?
Now, this is something we discussed on the podcast. And I think the worst vote off was Ben. I think that at that point in time, if Sarah wanted to take control of the game and have an opportunity to remove Tony, voting off Ben wasn't going to be beneficial for her at all. I mean, the jury, there was no love for Ben on the jury. It didn't appear to be a big move or anything just because Tony wasn't involved in the decision. It was really kind of a head scratcher because if anybody could have beat Tony in Fire, it would have been Ben. Ben was going to be anybody in Fire. So if she hadn't voted out Ben and voted out Michelle instead, then you've got Natalie, Tony, Sarah, and who else? Natalie, Tony, Sarah, Denise? And Ben.
Oh, and Ben.
No, yeah. And Denise has gone to that point already. Yeah. So you have those four that are remaining. And I think at that point in time, Sarah and Ben could have come together and really eliminated Tony because no matter who wins in that final four challenge, I think Tony is going against whoever is going to be making Fire. And if Ben is standing there, Ben's going to be going against Tony making Fire. And at that point, Tony could get eliminated, and then we have a Sarah, Ben, and Natalie final three instead.
Yeah.
Not that I wanted Tony to lose. I'm just saying.
Right. From the standpoint of the people who did the voting. I wasn't sure exactly if this question meant the answer you gave or like emotionally, what was the worst vote?
Oh, yeah.
So if it was emotionally, I would say it was Ethan because that was, I was barracking for him. and also just, I think I wore it. Let's see. Do I have my veil here handy? No, it doesn't look like it. Oh, I forgot. I turned that into a mask. But I think I wore the veil for Ethan the first time there.
Yes.
And so, but yeah, strategically was the one you mentioned.
Yeah, I agree that the Ethan one hurt a lot. That was painful. Because, yeah, we were rooting for him. All right. So Stan asks, Tony provided a great example of lowering your threat level despite having an outsized personality and an even bigger reputation heading into an all-winter season. What are other concrete examples of lowering or minimizing your threat level when coming back as a returning player?
I think we can look at the other two-time winner, Sandra, as a good example. In her second season, she made it seem like she was no threat at all. Recall that she told Russell he could take her to the end and she wouldn't get any votes. And then she told us, I don't know about that. another good example was Tyson, who faked his shoulder injury. He didn't fake the injury, but he acted like it was much worse than it was, which made him less of a threat. I don't know if you have any others that you can think of.
Well, I think Jeremy might be a good one, too. Because he was, I think that the first time that he played, I mean, he switched up his game where I think he was a little more kind of aggressive, a little more, the nice guy, I think, came out more the second time he played. I think the first time he was frustrated with Natalie ended up, he and Natalie were working together. And I'm trying to keep them straight with when he played. But, you know, Val had gone home and he managed to keep that in check when he lost Val, as opposed to, I feel like the first time he played, he got a little bit more aggressive because he was responding to people being voted out that he was working with, where I feel like the nice guy has really kind of come out more with Jeremy as he played.
Yeah. All right. Corn Muffin 19 asks, after playing the game yourself, why is the water well such a hot spot for game talk?
Listen, Corn Muffin 19. I love the name. I'm just going to start there. That's amazing. It's interesting. I think that the water well is such a hot spot because it's the only excuse you really have to go off with other people, because everybody needs water and everybody needs to fill their water jugs. And so if somebody says to you, hey, do you need water? You could be like, oh, you want me to go with you? And it's almost like a safe place to have two people walking off, even though everybody knows those people are going to be talking. It's not like you see two people just walking off into the woods, because if two people are walking off into the woods, then it's like, oh, well, they're definitely going off to strategize. Whereas people going to the water well together, it's almost like a natural thing because that's where everybody goes. Everybody goes to the water well. And also, I think that there's more of a comfort built into the water well, just because, you know, anybody could show up. So there is almost a hesitancy as well to really say too much, because a Nick might come up behind you and all of a sudden be listening, you know? Or a Tony might be up in the tree. We now know that. But so I do think that it's a place that people feel that they can come together because you have an excuse to be there. But I also think now there's probably going to be more concern about speaking at the water well, considering how creative he really was in setting up the spy nest right above the water well.
Yeah. Like we said, last week, you know, you got to search behind every bush, search under every bush, search up in every tree. And but otherwise it sounds like it's the cliche water cooler at work.
Right.
You know, the water well.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, now we are going to Genevieve Stone, who asks, how much does being a police officer influence how certain people play? You mentioned in the previous podcast how Ben's military training influenced his decision with Sarah. A lot of what Tony talked about sounded like it at least should come from cop training.
Yeah, I agree completely. I was thinking the same thing. The way he described, you know, talking from the lower ground and slouching, you know, all of that was classic in terms of body language training to make people not see you as a threat. And I do wonder how much of it came from police training, how to diffuse a situation. You know, if you don't want, you want to bring someone in peacefully, you make yourself look like less of a threat, or undercover kind of training.
Absolutely. So,
yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
I mean, I work with a lot of police officers who have been trained doing interview techniques and how you actually get somebody talking. And I think that one of the, you know, things that we saw Tony do was he was very good at being receptive to what he was being told this particular season. He wasn't as receptive in his previous seasons, but again, he learned. And so I do think that he probably utilized a lot of that training and carried it into this season in particular. Whereas I think he was, you know, different previously, but definitely we saw those types of things, like you said, the body language and just how he was interacting with people for sure. I think that came into play.
Yeah. All right. Several different people asked which players improved from their previous seasons by correcting errors, which players repeated their errors or showed new weaknesses.
Well, can we say Tony again?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I won't beat a dead horse here. Yes. Yeah. I mean, Tony clearly improved his previous game. I do think that there was other people that probably struggled here. I do think that Ben was someone who I think overcorrected because he was really interested in having a group of people that he could actually play the game with and that he would vote with him. And that became a very important piece of this game for him, so much so that I think he lost some of the Ben that we really needed to see or wanted to see, and that would have probably propelled him further in the game, just being viewed by the jury differently. I do think someone like Nick, we saw a different representation as well, and that might have been editing, I don't know. But Nick certainly, I think, struggled this season because he couldn't pull off what he did the first season. I mean, the first season, he wanted to play up that Kentucky boy kind of personality. I don't think they knew that he was a lawyer when he played the first time. So clearly he was kind of under the radar as far as what his intelligence level was. So I think this time, I think it was a struggle for Nick because cat's out of the bag. Everybody knows you and everybody knows how you're going to be. I think also Kim struggled here because Kim came into this game being so revered as playing a perfect game. And she actually talked about it with Jeff after she lost that final immunity challenge, not even immunity challenge, a challenge to come back into the game, and how she realized she didn't need to play a perfect game, but she saw the pressure that she had on her coming into an all winter season, having to play a perfect game and not getting able, you know, being able to do that. She couldn't get her footing. Yeah. So I do think that that was someone that I saw play a much different game because she just couldn't play the game she had played previously.
Right. Yeah. I mean, since they're all winners, it's hard to improve upon those seasons for most of them. You know, you won. It's hard to improve on winning. Sure. So without going through all of my podcast notes for the season, you've already hit on, you know, a lot of the key ones with Tony being good, Ben being not so good. In the other not so good area, I'd say, unfortunately, Sandra tried to play the game differently and it backfired on her.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob tried to play the same as if he were playing against naive newbies. And that obviously did not work. A bunch of winners are not going to listen to you when you boss them around and try to put them in jail.
That is true. That is true. All right. Our next question. Batom?
We'll go with that.
All right, I'm going to say from Batom. What do you think about Tony's strategy of dividing players into lions strong and hyenas weak, and then clearly voting out the weak, then the strong, then the weak, then the strong, almost to perfection? Is your famous rule finally getting the recognition
infamous,
it deserves?
Infamous rule.
Oh, infamous. I apologize. I was just going along here. Is your infamous rule finally getting the recognition it deserves?
I would love to think that Tony voted that way because he understood Appendix A. I just don't think that's quite what he was doing. That said, he did want to make sure he kept the lions around, but not too many lions. So, you know, he would take out a hyena and then take out a lion who wasn't part of his pride. And that does go along. I mean, the weak than the strong than the weak, the strong is not meant to literally be every other person.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly, you know, in his case, worked that way.
For sure. I mean, I think Tony was voting people out. In addition to having those categories, he was also looking at those that were going to negatively affect his game. And he was adding that into his reasons for now this person needs to be targeted because they're targeting me. They're a threat to my game. So regardless of being a hyena or a lion, he was still willing to vote them out depending upon where things were in the game. But I love the designation because I do think it helps. When you're dividing people up, you are creating division that didn't exist before. for other people that are playing the game with you. And it's an incredible strategy to pull off.
Yeah. All right. Bob Paulus, sorry, Bob, if I mispronounce that, asks, does Tony's amazing game fall short of perfection because he came within a few seconds of elimination in the challenge when Yule was voted out? Had Wendell placed his puzzle piece a second earlier, Tony would likely have been toast.
I don't think it falls short of perfection because this is just a ripple effect of the game, right? If that had happened, we wouldn't be discussing Tony in the way that we did. I mean, clearly his game would.
Or maybe we would have. I mean, it's not what we saw may have indicated that Tony. Sorry. What we saw may have indicated that Tony was going out, but we saw what the editors wanted us to see.
For sure. Yeah. And so it's one of those we just never know. Mm-hmm. But I do think that if Tony had gone home, we would have been impressed with his ability to play the game the way that he was playing it this season. But again, we don't know what would have actually transpired if Tony would have been voted out. And who knows, maybe Tony would have come back from the edge of extinction. So there's all kinds of potentials here that different avenues or paths that the game could have gone down. But I don't think that we would have been discussing Tony differently. We just would have been discussing him much sooner and why Tony lost and maybe coming back.
Yeah. And the other thing is nobody's game is perfect. Even Tony's game wasn't perfect. And many players who are seen as great have found themselves in similar situations where they either won a challenge or found an idol at exactly the right time.
Right. You
know, it's great to see a game like Tommy last season where he won without doing either. But even then, you can't always control other people. So
I
don't think it really affects anything personally.
All right. Andy Martin asks, in the second rule, you singled out Tony as being an exception when you said he backstabbed too soon and made unnecessary moves despite winning Kageyan. But after his second win, does it make you rethink his first win being an exception, or did he play vastly different in both wins?
Yeah, Tony's play and win this time definitely puts his first win into more perspective. We all used to talk about how he was a unicorn and it was a special situation where it worked. You know, he had Trish doing this and he had this specific setup and there was no way that would ever work again. And it did. So, yes, I'm already rethinking what I've said in the rules about him, and there will definitely be changes going forward.
Oh, see, spoiler. There's going to be a change.
I have lots of notes to change. Now, the order of the rules, nothing like that's going to change because then we'd have to, you know, reprint T-shirts and posters and stuff. But just the contents of, you know, the specific advice within them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Deb asks, why does Survivor hide how great Sarah is at forming relationships?
I'm curious about this as well, and I feel like there's a potential that Sarah is just not as outgoing as someone like Tony. And
nobody's as outgoing as someone like Tony.
They're really not. But I do think that Survivor is clearly a show that wants to entertain people. And if you are more entertaining, then it's easier to show that on screen. And it's very difficult to show someone who's just good at actually forming a bond, because that's not a big move. It's not something that you can actually point to. It's just someone who's very good at developing a relationship and being trusted. You really can't show that on camera besides having her talking to someone. And again, it's not someone hiding up in a tree. You know, we'll compare it to that. So I do think that that's part of why Sarah probably gets shorted a little bit on her edit, is because it's difficult to show things like that. She's not as flashy. She's not in your face. She's really just maintaining very good social bonds, but she's not winning immunity challenges and she's not jumping out of trees and she's not, you know, finding idols, but she's doing a lot of the groundwork in order to get people to work with someone like she and Tony. And so that's hard to show.
Yeah. I like you said, I don't think it's so much Survivor hiding it as it is that Survivor in general isn't great at showing the social game. We saw that, you know, I just mentioned Tommy. We saw this last season with Tommy, for example. You know, we didn't really get to see him play his social game, even though that's clearly what won it for him, because it's just difficult to show. And I think Sarah is similar.
Mm-hmm. Now, Terry Porter is curious, who caused other players to play emotionally?
I don't think too many of them were playing emotionally, but as to who caused others to do it, I would say Sarah was probably the best example, which is funny because we were just talking about how we didn't get to see it. You know, she got Ben to lay down and die for her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we talked earlier that that was a mistake, but still, that's how good her bond was with him, that he reacted emotionally. I do think keeping her own emotions out of it, but getting others to play emotionally is one thing that Sarah does exceptionally well.
Yes, for sure. And also, we could potentially throw Denise in here as well, because again, and it goes back to Ben. Ben didn't want to vote Denise out because mm-hmm. he had such a close emotional connection to her, calling her Mama D. So I do think that Ben was more receptive to people giving him, you know, just love and affection. And just like, I don't know, I feel for Ben because he really did kind of fall into this pattern of, wow, this person wants to play the game with me, and this person cares about me, and I'm going to have a friend when this is all done. And that became more significant to Ben. And so I do think that he was someone who was definitely affected by the way other people were playing with him.
Yeah. All right. So Tomas Zelenka asks, what actually came after Sarah the cop and Sarah the criminal? Lacina, the FBI or CIA agent? What criminal law profession did her game evolve into?
Interestingly enough, I don't think it's a real profession, but it is a job in itself. I think she became a confidential informant. That's what I think. You know, where she's working with Tony as the, even an undercover officer, if you want, but, you know, she was working with someone who was hiding up in the trees and bringing people to him in order to learn information. So she had to formulate these bonds and these relationships with people, create trust in them so they would share information with her, like having an idol, who they wanted to vote out, how they wanted to play the game. And then she would go back to Tony and tell him everything, or he'd be up in the tree listening. And so I think she was really acting as if she was a confidential informant or an undercover officer in order to get the information that she and Tony needed to move forward.
So, yeah. So basically the spy nest was essentially her wearing a wire.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was like, for sure.
Yeah. I actually had the same answer. So, yeah,
that's incredible. All right. So Meredith Robinson asks, am I a hypocrite if I stan Queen Sandra, but don't understand or fully embrace the love for Michelle?
I don't think, Meredith, I don't think you're a hypocrite at all. Everyone's allowed to be a fan of anyone they want. Mm-hmm. I do particularly, you know, like Michelle. And part of that is her in-game, and part of it is our out-of-game interactions. Not right. that we're, you know, I mean, we haven't had many of them, but, you know, I've just seen her in other things. And so, you know, I think they're two different players. Obviously, there are some similarities in the game, but they're not all the same. So, no, I don't think you're a hypocrite at all.
And I do think, from having met both of them, not in the game, but just outside of the game, obviously, you do get to learn a lot about both of those people. And I do think that what you see on TV is somewhat representative of how they are in real life. I mean, Sandra is very much in your face and will tell you exactly what she thinks, but it's enjoyable. And she's a joy to be around. She's entertaining. She's fun. And Michelle's the same way. I mean, you want to talk about someone who is willing to sit down, have a conversation with basically anybody. That's Michelle. And I've seen that, and she's very good at it. So both of them, you can stand for different reasons, but they are both, incredible people, but you don't have to stand them both. You can pick one. It's fine.
All right. Gareth Bate asks, where would Michelle's game have to change for her to win? To me, she needs to sit with Nick, Ben, and maybe Denise to win. What's the path for her? I think it's possible, as she is popular. She apparently had 4 votes against Tony, but they didn't want Natalie to win.
I know. I was fascinated by that there were people who wanted to vote for her, but they were concerned that they mm-hmm. might end up causing Tony to lose by voting for Michelle, so she gets second. So I do think that what she really needed to do was likely sit with those people that you've listed, a Nick and a Ben potentially. But I also feel like Michelle, she was too inclined to go along with what was happening, even though she was trying. I mean, she was definitely trying to rally the troops and trying to get people to think about votes and do things differently. We saw her do that once, and that was when she and Jeremy really took control and ended up voting out Ethan and sending a message to Adam at the same time. I mean, that was a moment that really Jeremy and Michelle kind of created. And I think she could have gotten some, you know, something rolling there, something moving. But obviously the game shifted and moved and people were switching and alliances were changing. That I feel like she was never really on top and really grabbing the control that she had at that moment. So I think maybe if she had done something then, she could have started some momentum. But it was more easy for her at times to just kind of go along with, well, okay, this is what they told me they're doing, so that's what I'm going to do because there's nothing else I can do.
Yeah, I don't really know what her path to win would have been. I mean, it would have had to start much earlier in some ways. Now, sitting with Ben, that would have been a definite plus. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure whether or not she could have beaten Nick in that situation. And this is the problem with a lot of hypothetical questions is you don't know what else has changed to get to that hypothetical situation. So, you know, how would she have gotten there? Did she win every immunity and power her way to the end and then also take control of the game because she had immunity? I mean, if she did that, yes, I definitely think she could have beaten Nick. If Nick won every immunity and dragged her along, then no. Right. So it's so difficult to say in a lot of these hypothetical situations.
I do think that we're going to see a question down the list that would touch upon this, though, and a decision that she could have made differently that also could have affected where she ended up in the mm-hmm. pecking order. But we'll get to that.
Yeah.
All right. Am I next here?
You are next.
I am next. All right. So, is this NBA discussion is asking, it is. Since Michelle knew the vote. Ah, here we go. Knew the vote was Tyson. Why didn't she tell Kim to play the idol on Tyson? It's a big move and puts her in a great position.
I think there are several possibilities. One, she was constantly trying to get into the majority and could have seen this as a way in if she voted properly. But also, remember that we talked about at the time, the majority plus the stolen vote had enough to split the vote successfully. So if Kim had played the idol on Tyson, Denise would have gone.
Mm.
It wouldn't really have changed anything for that side. Michelle would have been in with Kim for, hey, this is who it's going to be. And Kim would have trusted her. But then she'd have been on the outs with Sarah, who apparently told her how to vote.
Right. Which is interesting because I thought they were like, don't tell anybody what we're saying.
Yes. Well, don't tell anybody, except I'm going to tell Michelle.
Right.
She was an undercover officer. So
that's right.
So, yeah, I think that I don't think it would have mattered.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. They were splitting the votes. So, and again, it is a woulda, coulda, shoulda, would it have worked? But it was interesting. She did know who they were voting for and didn't give any indication whatsoever to play it for Tyson. Maybe because she was hoping the majority would let her join their team.
Yes. Now we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back. We're back, so let's get back to the show. So the next question is from Mancy. Mancy with an M, not an N. If Ben was put to fire making against Tony or Sarah, would he have fallen on his sword and let them win to final three? Mancy thinks they might have. He might have.
You know, I don't think he would have. And this is why I think that scene that we saw with Ben and Sarah, where it was kind of like he had a realization that he wasn't going to win this game, but he really wanted Sarah to win. I don't think he really wanted Tony to win. I think he had a lot of respect for Tony, but I think if it was between Sarah and Tony, he clearly was in the Sarah camp. And if there was an opportunity for him to sit at least next to Sarah, I think he was willing to lose to Sarah because of the friendship that he had with her. So I think if it would have come down to that, Tony and Ben are likely making fire against each other. And Ben will tell Sarah at that point, I'm falling on the sword. I want to sit next to you because I think you need to win versus Tony winning. And that's likely what we would have seen in that particular situation.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would say, I don't know if you were using falling on the sword the same way as it was intended. I think if he had to make fire against Sarah, the question is, would he fall on the sword by letting Sarah win? If he had to make fire against Tony, like you said, I don't think he'd have fallen on the sword.
I see.
He tried to beat Tony so he could lose to Sarah at the end.
I see.
And I'd like to think he wouldn't have in either case. But I do think what I just described is pretty likely. Mm-hmm. You know, he could have made it obvious, too obvious, that he tanked if he wanted to do that. But, you know, would he want to give up his fire making title? I think against Sarah, I don't think he would have won. I think it would have killed him to be the one who knocked her out.
Yes. Oh, I agree entirely.
So I think he would have, if he were up against Sarah in fire making, I think he would have found a way to lose.
It would have been sad.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. So DP asks, what do you think was Ben and Denise's own thought process to get to the end and win? Taking each other and Sarah, did they think they could win against her? I'm curious trying to figure out their own stories to get to the end. Denise has the Queen Slayer story, but what else? Also, where the hell did Mama D come from? We already have a Mama C, and I didn't really need a mama nickname for Denise.
Yeah, it would seem. For Denise, yes, it would have been the two of them and Sarah. But Ben indicated he was solid with Sarah and Tony. And it was clear that he didn't care whether or not he won as long as one of those two did. So I don't think he saw a winning path for himself. He saw a winning path for his team, which we talked about last week. You know, unfortunately, we also talked about last week that we didn't get to see much of the story for Denise to tell once they got into the post-merge. I mean, yeah, she could refer back to I'm the Queen Slayer. And what did you do since then? Right. You know, that would have been the question. Now, maybe she had other things to talk about and we just didn't get to see them. I don't know. As far as Mama D, I don't know where that came from. I don't know if it's a nickname from real life. I've seen her say it on Facebook. But I have only been her Facebook friend after she got back from filming. Mm. So I don't know if it was a nickname that she got out there that she brought into her regular life or a nickname she had from her regular life that she brought out there. You know, maybe we're just working through the alphabet and there's going to be a Mama E in the next few seasons.
I do think, though, that with Denise, there's a really great story that comes with Denise as being someone who is viewed in such a respectful manner by people who play the game with her. I mean, there was a lot of respect for Denise, and I don't know if it was just because she was the older individual who was playing the game with them, but she's a beast too. I mean, she can win challenges. She won multiple immunities in addition to taking out the queen. And she did that in such an incredible fashion that I think Denise sitting next to someone like Ben, who had no Ben bombs this season, didn't have any immunity wins under his belt, I think would have gone a long ways for her. And she was talking about the idea of sitting next to Nick and Michelle. I thought the same. I mean, then you've got immunity challenge wins to kind of compare. And she's equal with Michelle and then also has the Queen Slayer. So I do think that there's a potential that she could have seen herself winning this game because there's a respect, but also she's really, really good out there. You know, she's mm-hmm. definitely thrives. So I think she could have done it.
Okay.
I wanted her to. She's my winner.
All right. I know. Josh Spalding asks, Ben gave Sarah the option of voting him out. Sarah chose to exercise that option, which, as we've discussed, worked out badly. Where does more of the blame fall for that move in your mind?
Oh, man, that was a tough scene to watch, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think it falls with Sarah, honestly, because it was her choice, right? She was the one that wrote on the parchment Ben versus Michelle. So ultimately, it really comes down to her. What Ben was doing was so heartfelt and moving and incredible. But I think what Sarah should have done in that moment was tried to rebuild him up and say, you know what, Ben, that's not happening. We're solid three. we wanted to go to the end together. We're going to the end together, and really try to kind of emotionally connect with him in that moment and try to figure out where he is in his headspace that he would be willing to do this, because he's not helping her game at that point. He's only making it worse. She's losing a number. She's losing an incredible ally who is willing to quit the game for you, essentially. You want to keep that guy around because you know if it comes down to a decision and a final three, who is he going to be taking with him? He's taking Sarah. You know, if Ben was the one who won and had to make a choice, Sarah's coming to the end because he wants her to win so badly. So I think that that really falls on Sarah.
Yeah. Now, as for, you know, that move also includes Ben giving up. So Ben certainly, as we discussed, you know, deserves the blame for doing that in the game sense, which is what we talk about. But yeah, you pretty much summed up the rest of it.
There we go. All right. Once Upon an Island asks, did Nick play any different this season than he did in David versus Goliath? He was under different circumstances, but it seems like he played a similar game, but given a doofus edit this time.
Yeah. So, Jessica, you already addressed a lot of this in an earlier question about how he couldn't quite play the same game because they know he's a lawyer. They know he's smarter than he, you know, tried to make himself out to be in David versus Goliath. So he couldn't play exactly the same game. And also it's hard to say for sure because we saw relatively little of him this season other than, you know, but
that was good.
But, you know, to me, it did seem like he was playing a similar game where he could. He was clearly given a different edit. And one that I don't think he was real happy with.
Mm-hmm. And I was surprised, too, that he was very aware of what was happening around him, but seemed to be perceiving it so much differently than we as the viewers were perceiving it. So I don't know what was happening on the island that was convincing him that he had as much power as he thought that he did and that he had relationships with people that he thought that he did. You would see him in confessionals a lot of times talking about how now he's taking over and he's in control, and he never was. So I don't know if people who he was playing with were just really great at convincing him otherwise, but it certainly was a much different view that we had of him. And the way that he was being shown was not someone who was in control of the game and making decisions that kind of left us all scratching our heads a little bit.
Yeah, I think that the answer to a lot of that is Tony.
Yeah.
I think that Tony played him much like Tony played Jeremy, and Tony played this person and that person, pretty much everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah. All right. Fish Slapper asks, what did you think of fire tokens and how could the fire tokens be improved going forward?
I don't know if I like Corn Muffin 19 or Fish Slapper better, but Fish Slapper.
If you put them together, do you have like a you know,
fish slapper corn muffin.
Yeah,
that's good. I like these names.
Yeah.
So the fire tokens are interesting to me because I do think that there is a certain benefit that they could bring to the game for the people who are actually in the game playing the game. I don't necessarily love the edge of extinction component where people are having you know, buying and selling things. And I will talk about Tony. And I know that we've already mentioned this in our last podcast, but he actually spoke in his exit press about if he had known that the money that he was paying for the disadvantage so that he could actually participate in the immunity challenge and the extortion that he wouldn't have paid for it had he known that Natalie was going to be able to use those fire tokens to buy an immunity necklace or not immunity, an idol, excuse me, that she could buy an idol when she got back into the game. So I thought that that was interesting that there's this realization that the people who are still in the game setting those fire tokens over to the edge of extinction are now potentially hindering those individuals who are still in the game because the people on edge are using those tokens to buy good things for themselves, like idols. And that to me really causes a problem with how the fire tokens are distributed.
Yeah. I mean, I would say fire tokens are less terrible than Edge of Extinction and Final Four fire making. But I don't think we can judge until we see how they work in a game without Edge of Extinction.
Yes, because for sure.
That's part of the main problem you just described is this back and forth. Mm-hmm. You know, people take fire tokens, they give them, then they send them back. We'll have to wait and see.
Yes. I mean, the idea of winning fire tokens after an immunity challenge and purchasing things in the game,
mm-hmm.
I think is one thing. Like if you're in the right. game and you can buy peanut butter, cool. You know, that's yeah. great. But when you've got other people who are purchasing things with the tokens that you're paying them and then they're hurting you in the long run, that's not so cool.
Yeah. I mean, it could set up an interesting situation where someone or, you know, several people have fire tokens and it's like, okay, we can buy a tarp. Mm-hmm. And that person's like, yeah, but I don't want to buy a tarp, but we're all freezing and cold and wet. And yeah, well, I don't care. You know, I'm going to use it for this thing over here.
Right.
And, you know, and so it has potential, but we'll need to see.
For sure. All right. John Schneider asks, now what we've seen fire tokens in practice, and they've seemed to be a part of the future of Survivor. How will you incorporate them into the future season's rules?
I don't think there's really anything to incorporate yet because, like we were just talking about, we've only seen them with Edge of Extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I need to see what happens in future seasons before altering anything. And in the meantime, people are just going to have to play it smart and, you know, use them wisely in the same way you would use an idol or an advantage wisely. Because that's really what they are, is they're kind of like potential advantages.
Yes. And I'm hoping that if they do continue them moving forward and they allow players to buy things with them, that one of the things that they can't buy is idols. I don't think they should be able to buy an idol. I still don't agree with that.
I bet they will.
I know they will.
All right. Giovanni Orlana asks, did the Edge of Extinction advantages change the game for the better or the worse?
Oh, really? Do you want me to get on this soapbox again?
Yeah, I know. Giovanni, you had to know the answer we'd give here before yeah. asking the question. That was just like setting us up.
Perfectly. It is. I mean, and here's, I appreciate that Survivor wants to keep changing and developing the game further and trying to make it new and different. But to me, we saw the backlash that happened when Chris Underwood won. And again, I'm not.
We were a big part of the backlash.
We were a huge part of it. But I love Chris Underwood. He's a great guy for sure. And he played within the confines of the game that he was given. And he mm-hmm. killed it. No doubt. Natalie, same thing. She crushed it on the Edge of Extinction. She's a beast. She played an incredible Edge of Extinction game. But I'll say this again, and I've said it before. The mantra, the thing that you always hear about Survivor is outwit, outplay, outlast. Right? Those are the three components. And if you're getting voted out first, you haven't done any of those three things. And then you're coming back in with 5 days left or 3 days left, whatever it is, and suddenly finding yourself in a final three. And I just feel like that goes against everything that we have been taught about Survivor. The one thing you don't want to have happen to you on Survivor is to be voted out. And if you get voted out, your game is done. Edge of Extinction has changed that. And so you can play a great Edge of Extinction game, as we have seen Chris Underwood do, we've seen Natalie do, but that doesn't mean they played a great Survivor game.
Yeah. Now, I think the question was more, you know, the Edge of Extinction advantages. And I don't know if that meant, now I read it a certain way, you read it a different way. I thought it was the ones coming into the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like sending in the, you know, the idols and the Houdini and yeah. the.
Well, listen, I got on the soapbox. OK,
right. I know.
Soapbox.
So I'll just answer. The answer is still for worse. you know, people who are we've said this before. People who are out of the game should not be interfering in the game. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was one thing we complained about the first Edge of Extinction, and they added more of it the second one. So, mm-hmm. yeah. No.
And again, Tony, I already mentioned it. Tony talked yeah. about how
right.
he was giving them tokens to them buy things that were going to be yeah. used against him when they got back in the game.
Yeah.
It's terrible. Okay, so we'll get off our soapbox there.
Hold
and
step down from the
Tommy Guam asks, Tony mentioned that the Edge of Extinction is not Survivor, and once voted out, that should be it. Now, Tony never used the God idol. But didn't that allow him to play a little more reckless in Kageyan? And if he did use it, how would that change his legacy, if any?
Having that idol might have allowed him to play a little more reckless. But having watched him this time, I don't know that he would have done anything differently. He might have just made stuff up in a similar way to how he lied and told people he could keep using that idol past its expiration date. Like he did this season, he showed Nick a fake idol and convinced him that, you know, Tony had two idols. Mm-hmm. Even though we didn't see any of that on TV, I firmly believe that is one reason that Nick and others took the positions that they did, because they believed that Tony had two idols.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And so I think that Tony just, he will do this no matter what he has. Now, if he had actually used it, again, we get back to this hypothetical situation. We would need to know the circumstances. You know, did he use it because everybody had turned against him? Well, then, yeah, that does change things. Mm-hmm. Did he use it because of one little thing? Well, maybe not. I don't know.
I think Tony really is, and I know we've already talked about this, just a great representation of how to adapt his game for the circumstances of what's happening around him. And really allowing the game to be played, he's a huge part of it, but he's going to play the game with everything that he's provided. I mean, we saw what he did with that, the disadvantage, mm-hmm. the extortion, and how he was able to still utilize his social game to get enough tokens to still be allowed to play an immunity challenge. Now, having played the game, if someone is not involved in the immunity challenge, well, then guess what? That's one less person that could possibly win. So it increases your chances to win. And the fact that so many people were willing to just give him tokens so he could compete and then he won is just incredible. But that goes back to his social gameplay. So I think he's very good at utilizing other components of the game in addition to those advantages and making them work for himself.
Yeah. All right. Giovanni Orellana had another question. Does Natalie losing prove that Chris's win was a fluke?
I don't think it shows it was a fluke. I think that this was something that Stephen Fishback talked about, and I think he agreed with Rob. Rob Cesarnino is the one that came up with this, that the win that Chris Underwood provided mm-hmm. with going to fire kind of tainted people's view moving forward, that if you are from the edge of extinction and you come back into the game, you have to go to fire. And it's because of Chris Underwood. So I think if anything, Chris Underwood has kind of set the stage or set the bar as far as what you need to do if you are on the edge of extinction and come back into the game, what expectations people will have of you. This yeah. playing a perfect game idea. And in this particular season, that perfect game included she needed to make fire against Tony in order to win. So I don't think it shows it was a fluke. I think that what we discussed when Chris Underwood won was how he really utilized the edge of extinction and did everything he needed to do coming back in to play that perfect game in order to justify a win. So I think that's what he's done by winning, is kind of setting the guidelines of what you need to do as an edge of extinction returnee.
Yeah, I would go even further than that. I don't know that we can take much of anything from these two situations, because first, hopefully we'll never see edge of extinction again. And then they'll both be flukes. Second, this was an all-winner season, which impacted on at least some of the jurors' decisions. We saw them talking about that. Do we really want an EOE returnee to win the all-winner season? And third, Natalie was literally voted out first. And while it doesn't seem like a huge difference to being voted out third, I think it's enough of a distinction there. And fourth, the jurors literally told Chris what he had to do in order to win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think there's that, you know, that combination of things.
It's rough. All right. Pranay Das asks, what would have been worse, a first boot winning a season in Natalie or a twice voted off castaway winning a season in Tyson?
I would say without a doubt, a first boot winning a season. If Tyson had made it back twice, he would have had much more time in the game than Natalie. But yes, he also would have been voted out twice. This is why I tweeted at the beginning of the finale when I was live tweeting that I would be at the time rooting against whoever returned from Edge of Extinction. And that would have included Tyson. No, it would have been difficult, but I would have been doing it. You know, there were people who were the equivalent of getting in my face on Tyson. Like, why do you hate Natalie so much? Did I say on Tyson? On Twitter. You know, like, makes a lot more sense when I say it the right way. But yeah, on Twitter, they were like, you know, asking me that. I'm like, I don't hate Natalie at all. Mm-hmm. I hate Edge of Extinction.
Right.
There is a difference. And then those same people were really confused when I was defending Natalie and saying she shouldn't have had to go to firemaking, because the people on Twitter who were arguing with me were, they were just not getting it. They thought that if I was arguing against someone, I must hate them, which it's Twitter. I get it. They automatically, you know, you're either with us or you're against us. That's much of the Twitter attitude. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I work in nuances. So. But, you know, that's my long answer to that is I still think Natalie winning would have been worse. But I can understand, you know, and this is why, just no more Edge of Extinction. No more. Stop it.
No, I do think that there is certainly differences between the two. And I do think that's why she ended up giving Tyson an idol as well, because she thought his chances of getting back in were extremely high. And if anyone had a chance to win, it might just be Tyson. Mm-hmm. Tyson had a lot of friends on that jury, a lot of friends. So that would have been a very interesting thing to watch. You know,
hold on. Let me ask you the next question.
Okay.
From Tommy Guam. If Tyson made it back again and played the same game Natalie did, would he have received more or less votes or the same results?
I think he had a very strong likelihood of receiving more. I know that Rob said that in order to play the perfect game, Natalie needed to go to fire. I don't know if Rob would have necessarily taken the same stance with Tyson, just because they do have such a close relationship. And I do think that Tyson would have gotten more respect for winning his way back in twice. So even though he got voted out twice, he could have used the reasoning, if you will, that, well, of course they voted me out again because I was the returning person from Edge of Extinction. So it made sense for them to get rid of me. But he did manage to kind of weasel his way back in when he won his way into the game the first time. So I could have seen him doing the same thing if he won his way back in the second time, kind of weaseling his way in and making some inroads. But I do think that spending so much time with the jury on Edge of Extinction taints people's ability to really vote for the best player in the game. And they might just be voting for someone they have a close relationship with or a bond with because they've gone through Edge of Extinction together. So you put that together with the fact that there's also relationships they had coming into the game before they even played the game together. These guys are friends. They've hung out together. There's the poker alliance. So I think there's a very strong likelihood that Tyson would have given someone a run for their money if he had been sitting in the final three.
Yeah, I think so. And also you have to look at, again, this is another one of those hypothetical changes. We don't know what he would have done in that time. Mm-hmm. If he had come in and taken a more active role than Natalie did, well, and maybe he'd have gotten more votes for that too. But then again, was there a more active role to take? Because the point was break up the five. That's all anyone could do. So I don't know. So yeah, everything else I was going to say, you've pretty much said.
Look at that. All right. So Thaddeus Mahew asks, very curious on y'all's opinions about how fire making has changed the last few winners. Does Tony win without it? Love your podcast. Thanks.
Yes.
We appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you. I mean, we've been pretty open that we hate Final Four fire making. That said, I don't think it changed the winner this time or in 39. It did have an impact in 38 because of what we were talking about. Chris was told it was one thing he had to do as part of his win. But in this case, I think Tony was winning no matter if he had been dragged along or if he had won immunity and not gone in. I think Tony was winning no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that could have changed it, I guess, is if he would have gone with Sarah, then the votes split. May have happened and we don't know.
Right.
Or the same thing could have happened with Sarah that happened with Michelle. The people who were going to vote for Sarah may have said, oh no, we need to give it to Tony for these reasons, you know.
Right.
We just don't know.
And I do think that it really depends upon who's actually sitting there making the fire. I mean, you look at Dominic and Wendell and what we saw happen with those two. I mean, Wendell went to fire making and Dominic didn't, and they still almost split the votes. I mean, it literally came down to a tie. So, you know, I do think that the gameplay speaks more to a jury than necessarily winning in Fire. But
which
in a
it
situation,
should, as we discussed last week.
Absolutely, it should. But it's also interesting that this has become a decision where if you want to take somebody out of the game, here's a way to do it. You know, and they wanted to take Tony out. So the only way we're going to take him out is we have to beat him in Fire. So it definitely changes the dynamics, and it puts a lot of pressure on someone like Tony to have to win because they recognize that's the only way he's going to stay in the game. Same thing we saw with Ben. He was a walking dead man until that fire making challenge. And then all of a sudden here he was in the final three and then winning.
Right. All right. Next question. And this is a surprise question from someone named, hold on, let me make sure I pronounce this right. David Bloomberg. He wants to know, now that Survivor is casting as young as 16, would you allow your daughter to do it right now?
Oh, listen, we're already working on her video. Let me tell you. We have been discussing what she needs to include, how she should put it together. She is the one who made my video that got me noticed, that CBS was incredibly impressed with. So I absolutely fully support my daughter applying. She can handle it, even though she's 17. I know she can handle herself out there. She's basically like a 30-year-old woman in like a 17-year-old's body. So I think she'd be okay. So, yes, that is happening, CBS. Get ready. Get ready for the next Lewis.
That's right. You'd better be ready, CBS. She's coming for you.
That's right. So we're coming up with some theories. And I will say that there are a lot of people in my town who are her schoolmates who are applying and have already sent in videos because they know me from being on the show. And they've been Survivor fans, but yes, so it's happening, CBS. You have opened the floodgates, so I hope they are ready.
Yeah, I hope I'm ready for that. I don't think I am. But
well, by the time she would actually, if she were on the show, she'd be 18.
Yeah.
So, but that would be awesome. Yes. All right, so the next one, no secret questions anymore.
No.
From Brian Kobik, assuming this terrible twist of allowing 16-year-olds to play on future seasons comes to fruition, will you change, add any new rules? How do you think playing with 16-year-olds changes the overall strategy of the game?
There won't be any rule changes. No matter what age you are the rules and players need to follow them. As for how playing with 16-year-olds changes the strategy, probably depends on the 16-year-old. You know, you were just talking about your daughter who is mature beyond her years. Some aren't.
Right.
And, you know, then again, the same can be said about 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds. Anyway, it has to be an individual situation. So you have to just deal with them as best you can. Now, if I was cast on a season with a bunch of 16-year-olds, I'd be like, oh, shit. You know, it would be like how Rudy felt in the first season where he's like, I don't know how to deal with these people. I don't know what the MTV is. And, you know, but I gotta adjust to them.
Yep.
And that's exactly it. I would have to adjust to the 16-year-olds if they're in the majority. I mean, if there's only one or two of them, you vote them out unless they're your daughter. But
thank you.
Yeah. But yeah, if it's like a whole tribe of teenagers or something like that, and then there's a swap, yeah, you just got to deal with them like you deal with any other person.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have like a Lord of the Flies situation here where there's a whole bunch of kids running around an island.
And several people died on that in that book. So I hope
I know that would be really. But that's what I'm saying. I do think that if CBS ends up casting 16-year-olds, there is not going to be a full tribe of them. They might have a couple and they're going to pick people who I think appear to be more mature than they actually are, that act more mature than they actually are. If you look at the people that they have cast thus far, the 18-year-olds, all of them have come across much more mature than you would necessarily think an 18-year-old would be in a circumstance like that. So I think CBS is very mindful of that. I mean, I played with Will and Will, I knew he was young because obviously he announced it day one, but he didn't ever act like a very young individual. He was someone who was very mature, set in his like ways, the goals that he had for life and things he wanted to do. And so I think that CBS would would take those things into consideration and not be casting 16-year-olds that act like children, but more act like young adults.
Yeah. Okay. All right. FQ has another question here. Due to COVID-19, do you think Jeff Probst would allow a season to be filmed within the U.S.? If not, how long before we are likely to see another season of Survivor?
Hopefully it's not that long. I don't think they'll ever do a season in the United States unless they, I don't know, maybe Hawaii. They want to have an island somewhere. That would be great. I think you lose some of its luster when you keep things in house and you fall more into a maybe a Big Brother kind of situation.
So you don't like Rob's idea of Survivor of the Old West?
Yes, I thought that was hysterical. I think there's definite promise there, but I think one of the things that the viewers appreciate is the scenery. However, because it's been Fiji so many times, we are now also losing that too. So who knows? Maybe people would love it if all of a sudden it switched up and it was, you know, the wild, wild west, or it was in Hawaii or something a little bit different. But I do think that that's part of what makes it so interesting, is it's things that we are not accustomed to, that we're not necessarily used to. We're in a different country and you really are isolated. I mean, the islands in Fiji that they utilize, I mean, that's it. There's nobody there. You know, very, very isolated. So I think that would be a tough thing to pull off here. And I hope they have a new season soon. I really do.
I mean, I think if filming in the U.S. is the only option, they will film in the U.S. You know, if they have the choice, have nothing on the schedule for fall or film in the U.S., I think they're going to film in the U.S. And I mean, I think that they'd film in Antarctica if that were the only option, you know, but I even with that, I think CBS and Jeff are being very optimistic in thinking they can film anywhere in time for the fall season. Even CBS released its fall schedule and said, we're optimistic that this is what's going to happen. I think the word is overly optimistic.
Yeah,
I think that they are. I understand why they're doing it. They want their advertisers on board and they want, you know, they don't want people to say, oh, you know, fall season's gone. I think it's overly optimistic. I hope I'm wrong.
I feel really bad for the people who were cast and told they were going and then were like, oh, by the way, now you can't. So you're on pause, because I know for me,
you didn't quit your jobs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I had to change so many things and prepare so many things in my world knowing I was going on this show. And for these people who were ultimately, you know, going to be doing the same thing to then not be able to, it's got to be so heartbreaking to be dealing with that.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, am I the next one here?
You are.
Sorry, we have to follow this list here that David made. There's so many rules, David.
Always.
I know. Okay, so spoiler alert. This question pertains to the most recent seasons of Australian and South African Survivor. So if you haven't watched them but intend to, fast forward a couple of minutes. Stop listening. Okay, I'm going to go now. Yeah. All right. This is from John. John. Who's the greatest world Survivor player ever? Tony, David from Australia, or Rob from South Africa?
To my mind, without a doubt, Tony.
Wow.
David is good, but there's no way he could duplicate his performance now that his playing style is well known. And I know we said that about Tony, too. So maybe someday David will show that I'm wrong. But I just don't see it happening. Rob in South Africa was good, but his fellow players were not the most brilliant as a whole. So he kind of got a bonus there. Tony has done this twice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, someone can call me back if David plays again in Australia in a few years and does the same thing. But until then, I'm going to say that it is Tony.
Now, I haven't watched all of Australian or South African Survivor, but I have seen a couple of the seasons. And I will just throw this in there, too. It's a much different game than what is played here. And I think it's just because how long Survivor has existed with the American version of Survivor versus the Australian or South African. it's almost like they have to, I mean, they're very entertaining. And I think it's very entertaining because it is a more like old school Survivor. And so it's kind of like getting their, you know, feet underneath them and starting, you know, the momentum moving into the direction that Survivor has become with the American version of Survivor.
All right. Our final question from Ron Chan. What is the number of players from this cast that we will see play again, over or under 7.5?
Ooh, well, I'm not much of a betting person because I'm very bad at that kind of stuff. But I do think that the old school players are done. I do think that, you know, we can look at that division that was created, old school versus new school, and say, okay, they've officially retired. They were very clear in the Ponderosa videos that they were retiring, that this was like a closing a chapter for them, that this part of their life is over and they had moved on. And it was really incredible things to see, really. I mean, these are people that we've learned to love throughout the years. And then to hear them talk about what Survivor meant for them and what it means now, that they can walk away and they can feel good about what they've done. But I do think that there is a strong likelihood that we might see some of these players come back. And I don't know exactly who CBS would point to say, yes, we want that person to come back. But, you know, there's potential there. There's certainly potential there for some of the more recent players to come back and play again, who, you know, this was only maybe their second season playing. So, and that's so weird to say only their second season playing, but we have seen so many people come back 3-4 times. You know, there's been quite a few of those. So I think the new school players likelihood is very high that some of them will be asked again.
Okay. Yeah. I have to take the under 7.5. I think we're going to see some of these winners again, but I don't think it'll be more than half a dozen, you know, it's unfortunate, but you know, we'll see. All right. That's it for the questions and answers. So before we wrap things up, let me remind everyone that the rules that we talked about at various points are available in both poster and t-shirt form. For the shirt, go to robhaswebsite.com and or robhasapodcast.com and click on the merch link. Sort to see newer items first. For the poster, go to tinyurl.com/davidrulesposter2.
Yes. And as you can see,
yes,
beautiful.
I also want to encourage people to check out the RHAP patron program at robhasawebsite.com/patron. Once you join, you'll see that Rob does at least 9 patron only call in shows a month, plus a weekly Q&A show with Nicole, plus trivia contests, plus several shows are live streaming to the patrons. Plus, there are discounts and first access to live show tickets whenever that happens again. In the meantime, the Facebook groups keep plenty to keep you occupied with a great community of people. You know, we'll be talking about all the shows that are going on, all the podcasts, that is, you know, when we do this look back and everything else. If Big Brother ends up coming on, of course, they'll be talking about that. So remember, go to robhasawebsite.com/patron. Once you get to the Facebook groups, as we had a couple people do here, make sure to say hello.
Right. They said hi to us, just like we've asked. And it really is a great group of people, individuals that love all of the same television programs that you do. So if you want to get into some really deep discussion, that's a great place to do it. We also would love it if you would follow us on Twitter. And as you can see, our fancy Twitter handles are on the screen. At least they should be, right, David?
Yes.
So we have at David Bloomberg and at Jessica Lewis 89. So you should definitely follow us both. Unfortunately, you know, we live tweet during the episodes, but because Survivor is done, sadly, there won't be any live tweeting during the episodes. However, we do tweet throughout the week and there's a lot of Survivor content. So you should definitely check us both out again at David Bloomberg and at Jessica Lewis.
Yeah, now you get the, you know, exciting comments like whether or not my leg is trying to speak in Morse code. I'll leave that for people to figure out. You know, you'll just have to check it out.
You'll have to go to Twitter to see what that was all about. Right.
Now we need a hashtag here, and I do not have one off the top of my head.
I would love to do fish slapper corn muffin. because those are some great, great names. I'm sorry.
All right. There we go. There's our hashtag, fish slapper corn muffin.
People will be very
so congratulations to both of those listeners. You have made the hashtag.
I love it. Now, I dropped the 19 because I feel like it's just more clean if it's right, just corn right. muffin.
Yes.
But yes, I think those are great.
Yeah. And of course, there's a hashtag for this podcast overall, YX Lost. Make sure, everyone, that you're subscribed to all the RHAP Survivor podcasts at robhasapodcast.com/survivor, or just, go on your phone and, on your favorite podcatcher so you don't miss a single off-season show. We are also on the reality TV wrap-ups feed in both places. You can find the Know-It-Alls, the Wiggle Room, the B&B, This Week in Survivor, and whatever else comes up for, the stuff that we're doing in this off-season.
Yes. And we also need to say thank you so much to Scott St. Pierre for all of the editing that he does, both on the audio and now video version. So I hope you are all enjoying that we have introduced video into this. So thank you all for watching. So again, thank you, Scott, for all of the editing. And thank you to Will from America for the incredible theme song that you hear on the audio version. At some point, we will have David Bloomberg sing it on the video version, so you'll get to hear that too.
And then we'll have all these people turning it off right after the first couple seconds. Yeah,
it's a great tune, so thank you very much for that. We love it. It's great. Yes.
And thank you, Jessica, for another great week in our first week into the postseason here. Mm-hmm. I will see you and see all the listeners. Well, you'll see us next week for our look back at the very first episode of Survivor.
I love Borneo. I love Borneo so much.
So we'll see everyone there. Bye.
Bye.
If you lost Survivor and you're feeling down, David and Jessica will turn it around. They'll break down the rules and they'll show you how. You played yourself and got voted out. This is why blank lost. And this is why blank lost. Oh, baby.